Support for this episode comes from T-Mobile. We're a lot more than just baseball fans. We're baseball fanatics. And thanks to T-Mobile, we can stay connected to the game we love with 5G in more places. T-Mobile is your ticket to the game. So whether you're home or away, you're never far from your favorite team with America's largest and fastest 5G network. Don't get caught looking. Switch to T-Mobile, the leader in 5G today. Fastest according to OpenSignal Awards based on average speeds in USA 5G experience report, April 2021. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Welcome to episode number 57 of Unforbettable, where we take a look back at some of the less heralded Mets and our beloved franchise's quirky history. As to us, every player who dons the orange and blue is, in one way or another, unforbettable. I'll just dive right into it this week. We've had someone who's been suggested by a couple of people. We're going to go back, way back in Met history, back to 1964, which we visited recently when we looked at Charlie Smith. We're going to look at a player who came to the Mets in 1964 and who is mostly known in baseball history for being on the wrong side of some very prominent baseball history, not once, but twice. Once with the New York Mets, and that is Mr. Tracy Stallard. Tracy Stallard was born on August 31st, 1937, in Coburn, Virginia, and he loved to play baseball, and he was a local legend, as described in biographies and articles I've read on him. He was a tall, strapping 6'5", and threw very hard, and he was undefeated in his 4 years at Coburn High School, throwing two no-hitters in his senior year, which, of course, earned him the attention of Major League Scouts. And in 1956, he was signed out of high school by the Boston Red Sox. So hard-throwing and tall and right-handed, so, you know, all things that the Scouts love and love to dream upon. So he was indeed considered a promising pitching prospect with, you know, a lot of hopes for his development, but he did struggle early in the minors, particularly with command. If you look at his early minor league numbers, he generally averaged anywhere from 4.5 to 6 walks per 9 innings in the minors, even while striking out close to, or sometimes at some stops, even over a batter an inning, which, of course, you know, even in the minors was less common than it is in today's strikeout-heavy baseball era. But he did finally seem to start to put it together a bit in 1959. He started that in basically, I think it was the equivalent of Class A back then, and he went 9-4 with a 1.68 ERA in 13 starts, earning a jump up to AAA, where he continued to pitch well, putting up a 2.25 ERA. So he entered the 1960 baseball season on the cusp, it would seem, at the tender young age of 22 still. But he somewhat regressed in the minors. He didn't have as good a season as he did in 1959 in AAA, but he did get called up for a cup of coffee in September, making his major league debut on September 14th, 1960, throwing a scoreless mop-up inning against Cleveland in an 11-7 Red Sox defeat. One strikeout, one walk, no hits allowed in his major league debut. He got in only 4 games in the latter part of the 1960 season, most impressively his 4th and final game on October 1st, 1960, in the penultimate game of the year, facing a somewhat depleted but still impressive starting lineup against the New York Yankees, who were resting a number of their regulars on the way to the World Series, which they would be starting in just a couple of days. Tracy Stellard pitched two perfect innings of relief, striking out four batters. Most prominently, leading off the eighth inning, he struck out that season's soon-to-be-crowned MVP, Roger Maris. And, of course, exactly 1 year to the day later, Stallard would face the Yankees and Maris again in a game which would yield, for Stallard at least, historically disappointing results. The 61 season would actually start happily for Stallard, as he'd make the major league roster for the first time in his career, starting off as a swingman in the bullpen, ultimately joining the Boston Red Sox rotation in the second half of the season. For the 61 season, he appeared in 43 games, starting 14 of them. Mostly pitched in long relief, although he did pick up two saves early in the year, and he ultimately made his first start of his career on August 6, 1961, pitching well, but losing a 1-0 decision to the Kansas City A's. His very next start, he earned his first career win, going 8 2/3 innings in a 3-2 win over the Twins. The very Stallard-esque line of 5 walks and 8 strikeouts as he continued to flash those control problems that would kind of bedevil him or limit him over the course of his career. In fact, he, over his next 7 starts, he would go 1-5 with 1 no decision. That no decision was an outing against the Tigers and Jim Bunning, who he would match up with again, famously, as we'll discuss soon. And Stallard went 4 2/3 innings and walked 10 batters in that outing. But it was Stallard's final start of that season, for which he is probably most known in baseball history. October 1st, 1961, Stallard pitched what he considered to be the best start of his career to that point, and in subsequent interviews would ruefully note that felt like it might have been the best game he ever pitched in the majors. He threw 7 innings of 1-run ball, allowing only 5 hits, a walk and 5 strikeouts to a powerful Yankee lineup. Unfortunately for Stallard, that 1 run was one of the most memorable home runs in baseball history. In the first season with 162 games, of course, Roger Maris very famously went into the final game of the season, tied with Babe Ruth for 60 home runs for the all-time single-season home run mark. And after inducing Maris to fly out to relatively deep left in the first inning of the game, Maris, of course, came to the plate for the second time in the game in the bottom of the fourth, Stallard pitching wonderfully. He had retired 9 in a row. But fell behind Maris 2-0, and on the third pitch of the at-bat, Maris put one into the short right field Yankee porch, setting baseball history with his 61st home run, a new record that, of course, would stand for 37 years and would tie Stallard's name to Maris for pretty much baseball eternity. But Stallard was still a 23-year-old man with hopefully a long baseball career ahead of him, and one that, of course, would soon take him to the New York Metropolitans that we know and love. He would spend almost all of 1962 in the minor leagues in AAA, save for one relief appearance for the Red Sox. And in the offseason, the Red Sox would send him and Pumpsy Green to the New York Mets for Felix Mantilla. And Tracy Stallard, the young right-hander who, was having a hard time breaking into the Red Sox rotation, would, of course, join a team starving for young talent and where opportunities would be aplenty. A franchise just entering its second season in 1963, the New York Mets. Stallard's 63 actually started off a little bit like his 61. He was mostly pitching out of the bullpen before ultimately joining the rotation for the Mets in June of 63. He actually got off to a pretty hot start in his first 4 starts. He won 3 of them, throwing 2 complete games and going 8 innings in the third, raising his record to 3-4. No small feat for a team that had gone 40 and 120 the year before, and was 28-44 as of June 23rd, when he recorded that victory over the Phillies. Stallard would actually get his ERA as low as 3.58 by the end of June, but he would struggle late in the year. Now, obviously, it's can't really blame one person for the 63 Mets ineptitude, and probably there was not a lot of offensive support, but Stallard also didn't pitch well over the second half of the season and helped earn his 6-17 record, recording a 4.71 ERA, and just really struggling down the stretch. But obviously, you know, young pitcher, nascent franchise, so Stallard was going to be a member of the rotation again in 64. The team, I think, still hoped that he would develop. Honestly, I don't know what the Mets were hoping in 1964, but why not give a hard-throwing right-hander another chance? And while Stallard would lead the league in losses in 1964 with 20, a lot of that would probably fall to the team as a whole. As we all know, wins and losses, not always the best way to judge a pitcher. And Stallard pitched better in 1964. 64 and 65 were probably his best major league seasons. Indeed, Stallard had some highlights that year for the Mets. He threw 5 complete games in 1963. He threw 11 in 1964, including 2 shutouts. On July 25th of 1964, Stallard led the Mets over the Milwaukee Braves in a 10-0 victory. He threw a 3-hit shutout, walking only 2 and striking out 7. And then later in the year, on September 16th, he would throw a 4-0 shutout against the San Francisco Giants, out-dueling Gaylord Perry to raise his effort to 10-18. This again, perhaps one of the more impressive Stallard through with the Mets. 9 innings, 2 walks, 10 strikeouts, only 5 hits, a game score of 85. Definitely his 2 best starts in a Mets uniform. Alas, Stallard would lose his final 2 starts of the season. Won a 2-1 complete game loss to the Cardinals, and then on September 27th, he would go 7 1/3, surrendering 2 earned runs again, but take the loss to Cincinnati, as the Mets would fall in that game to 51-104, and Stallard would fall to 10-20, again giving him that lead in losses for the season, his only black ink on his baseball record, so to speak. But as a point of fact, again, this is a very, very bad Met team, as all of those early season teams were. And Stallard was one of the best performers on the 1964 Mets. Of course, Ron Hunt famously was the team's first All-Star and led the team in WAR, according to Baseball Reference, with a 3.2 mark. But Stallard was actually fourth on the team in WAR with 2.3 that year, trailing only Hunt, Galen Sisco, and Joe Christopher.
Thanks to T-Mobile for supporting this episode and for keeping baseball fans around the country connected to the game. Because when you're on America's largest and fastest 5G network, you get more than great coverage. You get to stay close to your favorite team, whether you're at home or on the road. In other words, T-Mobile is your ticket to the game. Make the switch to T-Mobile, the leader in 5G today. Fastest according to OpenSignal Awards based on average speeds and USA 5G experience report, April 2021. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Support for this episode comes from Locker Room, the app that's changing the way we talk sports. Locker Room is a sports fan's dream come true. It's a live audio platform that lets you connect with other fans, experts, and even the athletes themselves. Locker Room makes it easy to start your own conversations. Talk about the latest rumors, takes, news, and teams you care about most. Join massive watch parties for all of your friends to react together in real time as you celebrate a buzzer beater or suffer the agony of a crucial bricked free throw. And if you've got a bunch of supremely spicy takes you'd like to fire off, you're in luck. You can even record the conversations if you want and release them as a podcast. So it's time to start thinking about catchy titles. It's all totally free and available at the iOS App Store right now. So go download it today. Locker Room, changing the way we talk sports.
He He appeared in 36 games, starting 34, and Key, Jack Fisher, Al Jackson, and Cisco comprised a semi-reasonable rotation that obviously did not have a lot of offensive or defensive support behind them. But besides leading the league in losses, it was one loss in particular, just another way in which, unfortunately, Stallard will most be remembered in baseball history as a footnote to other more dramatic accomplishments. And that was, of course, on Father's Day, 1964, June 21st, when Stallard would again hook up with Jim Bunning, as he did in that rookie year of his in 1961. Now, in 61, when they hooked up, as I said, Stallard walked 10 in 4 2/3 innings. And I think they just gave him that long because they were trying to get him his first career win, because Bunning was atrocious. He only went 3 1/3 innings, surrendering 8 hits and several runs, and did wind up taking the loss in that game, though Stallard would not get the victory. When they matched up on Father's Day 64, Stallard did get through 5 innings, actually getting into the 6th, getting roughed up for 4 runs, turning a 2-0 lead into a 6-0 laugher. On a day when it really wouldn't have mattered if he only gave up one run again, because Jim Bunning was absolutely perfect. Bunning would throw the 5th perfect game in modern baseball history, the 7th officially recorded perfect game from 1880. And actually, I guess the first modern perfect game in the National League, actually. In fact, entering the 9th inning, Bob Murphy informed the radio audience that not since 1880 has there been a perfect game in the National League. Bunning really mowed down the Mets. As they apocryphally say, there's usually one play. And with one out in the 5th, the Mets catcher, Jesse Gonder, hit a ball, a line drive between 1st and 2nd that Bunning believed was going to cost him the perfect game. No shift then, I guess, but the Phillies' second baseman, Tony Taylor, knocked the ball down in shallow right field and threw Gondor out from his knees, and from reports I've read, obviously probably anyone but the catcher probably would have been able to beat that out, but Bunning, after the game, acknowledged that when Taylor made that play, I thought I had something special going. Tracy Stallard was unfortunately long gone from the game after 5 1/3 when the Mets tried to break up the perfect game in the 9th. Casey Stengel clearly wanted to break it up, sending up a couple of pinch hitters in the 9th inning. But as covered in our earlier podcast, Charlie Smith popped out to short, and then George Altman pinch hitting and John Stevenson pinch hitting both struck out. Bunning's 9th and 10th strikeouts of the day, and he celebrated his perfect game on the Shea Stadium field with even the Met fans giving him a solid ovation. And less dramatically than giving up a 61st home run, but for the second time in his young career, Tracy Stallard, I guess, was on the wrong or losing side of baseball history. And while he did have a more effective year, as I kind of indicated, than the one-loss record would indicate, in the 1964 offseason, the Mets traded Stallard and Elio Chacon to the St. Louis Cardinals for Johnny Lewis and Gordy Richardson. Stallard was, of course, joining the defending world champion Cardinals, and for a bit in 1965, it looked like that Cardinal devil magic would rear its head again as he got off to a pretty good start with the Cardinals. ZRA was down in the mid-2s at one point in the season as a bullpen pitcher spot starter. And of course, it probably didn't hurt that he was playing on a winning team, but he did record the only winning record of his career, 11-8, and he finished the year with a 3.38 ERA, 40 games, 26 games started. But he did struggle later in the year, essentially losing his spot in the rotation with the Cardinals. And 66 would actually wind up being his last year in the majors. He would spend some of the year with the Cardinals at age 28, but most of the year in AAA Tulsa with the Cardinal organization. and would never again make it back to the majors after 1966. The Cardinals would go on to win the World Series again in 67, but he did not appear in the major league with the team. He spent all of 67 in Tulsa. But his major league career then ended actually at the age of 28, although he would continue on in the minors and in winter leagues and in Mexican leagues into his early 30s, trying to get back to the majors, but never quite making it. For his career, Stallard finished with 30 wins and 57 losses, a 4.17 ERA, appeared in 183 games, started 104 of them, pitched 764 and two-thirds innings, struck out 477, and walked 343. His career WAR, according to Baseball Reference, was 3.1. In two seasons with the Mets, Stallard went 16-37, rough .302 winning percentage, but then doesn't really help pitching for an expansion franchise. He had a 4.16 ERA with the Mets and recorded 2.3 WAR in his career with the Mets, again, thanks largely to that 1964 season. Regarding his unique spot in baseball history, Stallard was, at least when it happened and shortly after his retirement, was always very pleasant and affable about the experience, at the time saying, "I'm glad Maris hit the home run off me, otherwise I would never have been thought of again." That was all I thought about it, and I've had a good time with it. And again, he didn't really shy away from associations with it. He put in appearance, even though he was pretty reticent and quiet in his retirement. After he retired from baseball, he moved back to Virginia. He mostly stayed out of the public eye, but he would attend a charity fundraiser with the Roger Maris Golf Tournament in Fargo, North Dakota, several times, and generally seemed good-spirited about his spot in baseball history. However, for whatever reason, when Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa were chasing Maris in 1998, Stallard showed no interest in being part of all of the hoopla surrounding that, and refused numerous requests for appearances during that chase of Roger Maris that ensued in 1998. Unlike a lot of ex-athletes, Stallard didn't really get involved in coaching. He got involved in the coal business, apparently, and got very involved in, you know, his hometown in Virginia. A new baseball field at his high school was named after him. He lived near there until close to the end of his life, although he did die in Kingsport, Tennessee at the age of 80, and just a few years ago in December of 2017. But Tracy Stallard left behind a name that'll always be remembered in baseball history, and toiled for a couple of years as the New York Mets were just beginning their journey. And for that, he, of course, is unformidable. Thank you for taking the time to listen to Unformidable. Please go to AmazonAvenue.com for more Mets-related content. You can follow Amazon Avenue on all of the social medias, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can find this in any of our Amazon pods wherever you get your podcasts. Original music by Bunga. I'm on Twitter at WolfRR, WOLFFRR, and the show is at Unformidable. Thank you, and as always, let's go Mets!